from the Carter Subaru Studios. This is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Wojtyn.
Good morning. Happy Tuesday, and thank you for listening to the G and Ursula Show. Morning, Ursula.
Good morning, G. How are you feeling? Are you still in bed or have you moved to your couch?
Ursula, I'm going to keep it a buck with you. I'm doing radio right from the bed.
Don't get too used to it, buddy.
if that needs to be on everybody's bucket list, did you really do that? Yep, sure did. Matter of fact, I'm going to take a photo, Ursula, and put it on our Facebook page.
Okay, that sounds good. You need to take care of yourself, though.
Yeah. Hey, but we are going to have Dr. Angela Rasmussen, yes, our resident virologist. She's going to join the show at 10:33. Make sure you send in your questions. I already had some folks, Ursula, send some questions in for the good doctor. That happens at 10:33, but right now we have a guest.
Well, we do, but we want to talk about a couple of things before we bring our guest on. So we often bring up our region's homelessness crisis because it is a problem that seems to be keep getting worse, and there's no consensus on solutions. As we've told you, the number of homeless tents in the area has gone up by 50% during this past year, during the pandemic. There's also this new citizen initiative called Compassion Seattle, which would essentially force the city to build 2,000 units of housing in an effort to get the homeless out of tents, out of parks, sidewalks, and other public places. And then now the King County Regional Homeless Authority has a new CEO at the helm. And we want Hannah Scott to give you an introduction to who this person is.
Policy strategist and activist Mark Dones, who goes by they, them pronouns, is no stranger to the region's homelessness effort, having worked as a consultant as the city and county started the effort to create this new body. But they are somewhat unconventional choice. Dones' background, more from the world of racial equity and activism than direct homelessness services. They also have pushed out-of-the-box ideas, such as giving those who are homeless more of a say in how local governments respond to the issue. Now, Dones takes issue with the way the conversation surrounding homelessness has gone nationally.
We try to build solutions for, 1,500, 2,000, 4,000 people all in one go. And I actually don't think that's the best way to approach this. I think that we need to be looking at building solutions for 30 people, for 20 people, for sometimes 6 people, right? And those are frankly much easier to think about from a design perspective and frankly much more realistic in terms of what we have at our fingertips to turn online.
Asked what's not working?
Large congregate shelters do not work.
Dones says they and those who run congregate shelters in their own region know that they are not the answer. So the time for those is coming to a close in their mind.
So when we talk about what doesn't work, what we're talking about is a system that has not looked at the population in a segmented way and right-sized the things it is putting out in alignment with what people need and frankly are want to activate again. So what we'll be looking to do is right-size all of this.
So a couple of things, G, before we bring on our guests. So you heard that Dones, again, who is the new CEO of the King County Regional Homeless Authority, and he's jumped in with some controversy, which we'll be talking about in a minute. But he says he does not believe in large congregate shelters, that he thinks this is a problem that needs to be solved, maybe 5, 10, 15, 30 people at a time.
Okay. So I listened to all of that, Ursula, and there's two things that I have to say about it. Number one, I don't know that I really disagree with him. In my heart of hearts, I do kind of feel that a smaller scale approach to this would be better because so much detail is missed when you try to go larger scale. That's on one hand. On another, I'm going to say, and because I do agree with him, that also leads me to believe, hear me when I say this, we're never going to get to the bottom of this. Let me repeat that again. We are never going to get to the bottom of this until there is a sweeping change in other arenas. You know what I mean? Like, until we realize that it is unbelievable that these tents and all of the homelessness that we are seeing are literally next to Fortune 500 companies here. They're next to the millionaires in our area, in our region. So until changes are made in other ways, I think this approach might be better, yes, but this approach is also going to mean that this is going to be something. So meaning our grandkids, Ursula, and our grandkids' grandkids, if they are doing radio or they are talking about these discussions, they will be talking about exactly what we're talking about right now.
I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay.
I don't think that we will ever get rid of homelessness because that has existed, you know, forever. But we cannot continue at the pace that we are at right now. Too many people are going to die out in the elements, first of all. And so while I think he's saying it is realistic, I think that there's going to be a big clash here because, as we said, this Compassion Seattle initiative, which, frankly, I have said I am strongly in favor of, the one of the parts of it is the city would have to create 2,000 units of housing. If you're only going to do, and every single life that you save is a valuable life, so don't get me wrong. But if you're looking at it only attacking it 3 to 5 people at a time, you're right. That is not going to end up, I mean, it'll make a dent in it, but sure, just as many people will continue to move in.
One last thing, Ursula. 55 of the most profitable companies in America paid no federal income taxes. 55 of the most profitable. So as long as we continue with that trend, then the other at the bottom will continue to grow as well.
And absolutely. And it has to be a multi-pronged approach. So let's talk about all the different things that aren't working and maybe what could be some smart approaches, and who best to talk about that but Scott Greenstone at the Seattle Times, who we've had on the show before, and he joins us now. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so where are you weighing in? So we've got this new CEO. Just looking at what he said during the interview with Hannah and then looking at what Compassion Seattle is calling for, it feels like they're on two different planes.
That's a good question, or a good point. I think it's a little bit. There's two sort of major aspects to that. You know, Compassion Seattle is focused on what is happening on the streets, right? You know, obviously, Compassion Seattle is kind of saying let's build new housing, but it doesn't really provide funding for that. It doesn't say let's have new taxes or anything like that. It's basically saying let's build the spaces so we can get folks off the streets, and then let's get folks off the streets. And if we have to make them, we got to make them, you know. Mm-hmm. And Mark Dones, who you know is going to be running the Regional Homelessness Authority, they're focused more on what happens when we get those folks off the streets. Mark is not necessarily going to have much in the way of control over enforcement. That's up to cities. Cities get to say how they want to enforce or if they want to pass laws against homelessness. So we've got two different aspects here. I mean, obviously, they're not separate, right? If I have a record and I owe a lot of money to the court because I've been fined again and again for camping outside, it's going to be a lot harder for me to get off the street. So the two things are connected, but they're kind of these separate pieces of the issue.
Scott, do you know if the sweeps stopped during COVID? Do you know if they did anything to get people off the street, or do they just move people along? Talk about that, sir.
So yeah, the city has almost completely stopped, you know, removing homeless camps, right? They're still doing a few, and there's been a few high profile ones. I think we probably all remember Cal Anderson and the multiple, big police actions that happened there. But for the most part, they've stopped. And I think if you drive through Seattle, you can kind of tell folks are staying in the same place for a lot longer, pitching, you know, tents and being able to stay there. And there are I've talked to a lot of folks who live in RVs that they haven't had to move their RVs every 72 hours like they used to. So yeah, there's definitely, sweeps have stopped. But the problem is that everything has kind of stopped, you know, and shelters have gotten a lot smaller because you can't have 100 people sleeping in a room 6 inches from each other. You've got to empty that room at least halfway out, maybe more. And where are you going to send all those people? A lot of them want to, you know, would rather take their chances on the street where, or, you know, out in a tent where they're not scared of getting COVID.
Scott, you've been covering the homelessness crisis in this area even before this pandemic. And just a second ago, you said everything kind of sort of stopped. And it kind of reminds me of, yeah, you know what? Rent payments essentially have stopped because of the rent moratoriums that's been going on. So right now, if you will, over the last year, there's been a lot of things that's on pause, right? And so you have been covering all of this before the pandemic, and now here we are going through the pandemic. How do you see things happening once the rent moratoriums are taken away? And if you will, things aren't stopping like they used to. How do you foresee things happening in Seattle when it comes to the homelessness issue?
That's a really great question. You know, for the last year, I've been trying to figure out, are we actually seeing, you know, a rise in homelessness? Or is it just that it's super obvious now because we're not making people move from place to place, right? And I wrote a story last week that Ursula mentioned about, looks like we have seen a documented rise in tents. But when I talked to experts, they said, you know, jury's still out. Are these newly homeless folks? You know, are they homeless folks who've been homeless for years and now they're sort of coming into the open because they know they won't get swept? So, you know, that's a great question. There's with the eviction moratorium, you know, getting, you know, probably going to expire soon. If we don't have enough rent relief for some folks who have lost their jobs, you know, we've had a lot. The folks who, I've talked about this on the show before, but the folks who are the most sort of statistically shown to be the most sort of vulnerable to homelessness are those folks who are in like temp jobs, restaurant workers, seasonal workers, and those people are really feeling a lack of employment right now because the economy has not, you know, a lot of those jobs have not yet come back. We're not back in our offices yet, not all of us. And so we're not necessarily going down to the coffee shop in, you know, the business district. And so that coffee shop may have still laid off its baristas or several of them. And, you know, that until we sort of recover, those jobs may not come back. And the rent that those folks owe is still accruing, right? So I think you have a great point, G, that, yeah, we definitely could see things start to move a lot and in a really bad way when the eviction moratorium expires.
Scott, I mentioned earlier that the Compassion Seattle initiative would mandate that the city create 2,000 units of housing for the homeless. And I know that you recently visited the Executive Hotel Pacific downtown, which...
That's right.
How many people does that house or should that house?
Yeah, I believe in the end it's going to house over 100 folks. But here's the thing, house, you know, they've got, you know, they've got a lease. The idea is let's get these folks into this hotel room, but the hotel room is definitely, you know, not permanent. And for some folks, that's all they're going to need, right? Actually, maybe for many folks, you know, they get treatment. Maybe they get into inpatient treatment, or maybe, you know, other folks are going to go to a nursing home or something like that if they're severely disabled, which a lot of folks out on the street are. But there are some folks that are going to need, you know, housing that just doesn't exist anymore, housing that they can pay for with their Social Security. And that's not going to be those hotels. Those hotels gotta get replaced with something.
Okay, Scott, the other thing I wanted to bring up is that Mark Doan's was not the first choice for the position for CEO of the Regional Homeless Authority for King County. And I have heard that some mayors were concerned that his background is more in activism and social justice versus actually dealing with homelessness crises. What do you see as his biggest challenges moving forward?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think a lot of folks would say this, but looking at King County, and this is true, Ursula, what you pointed out is true. When Nancy Bacchus, for instance, the mayor of Auburn, voted to confirm Mark, voted, you know, in favor of confirming Mark as the CEO, also said that she had concerns with it. And that it sounds like a lot of suburban leaders kind of do. And I think it's pretty obvious to everybody, if you live in King County, there is, and maybe even if you live in Washington, there's, Seattle has some stigma. People think that we have not, I think people think rightly that we have not handled our homeless crisis very well, and they don't want that to happen, you know, in their cities. But the problem is they're not handling their crises at all for the most part. There's a few shelters outside of Seattle, but most of the folks who are living in Seattle's shelters, and Seattle has the most shelters in the region, are, you know, became homeless in other parts of King County, like Auburn, but there's not a shelter in Auburn, or at least not enough shelter. And so I should say there are shelters in Auburn, but so, yeah, so Mark is going to have to try and unite and persuade mayors to not get in the way of shelters or housing. Actually, Mark's, you know, goal is to focus more services around the county, and they, you know, they need to be able to get the county's mayors on their side. So the question is, are these mayors going to see Mark as an emissary of Seattle, or are they going to see Mark as a representative of the whole county?
This is Scott Greenstone. He's from the Seattle Times as he joined the G and Ursula Show. You can follow Scott on at @EverGreenstone on Twitter. Scott, you know, we the homelessness conversation has been something. And as someone who has been homeless myself, living in my car, I kind of have a little bit of an understanding. But here's the part that I wonder if it's going to move to. So for an example, Scott, if I needed a place to stay and you let me stay in your house and you made it, quote, affordable, or if you will, you just let me stay there, that's one thing. But if I don't make money, how can I keep that place up? So here's what I'm saying. Do you ever foresee the city of Seattle giving money to people that are homeless, because the only way for them to truly get out of things is for them to have income and money?
That's a great point, G. And you're not alone in saying that, right? I think we've talked before about studies coming out of Canada. A recent study came out of Stockton that shows that if you do just give folks money, not all of them are going to spend it on the things you might, you know, want them to. But by and large, they will save it. They will spend it on things that will help improve their lives. And I think you're right. And I think if any city is going to do it, it could be Seattle. But I don't know. Like you said, there's a lot of political infighting in Seattle. And when you're talking about giving money to homeless folks, that does tend to be a divisive issue. A lot of people have a lot of notions about the majority of homeless folks. I can't tell you how many emails I get every day that says, you know, that say, well, most homeless folks are on drugs. And I think that when they think that, when they say that, they mean the folks in tents. But the folks in tents only make up around 10% of the overall homeless population. There are way more people in cars like you were. At least the best data that we have says that. So I don't know. I think it's going to have to be Seattle overcoming and having a real serious conversation that is really honest and upfront about what facts we know about homelessness.
Scott Greenstone from the Seattle Times. Scott, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Dr. Angela Rasmussen will join the show. Please text in your questions for the doctor at 989-73. You guys are listening to the G and Ursula Show.
Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show on Cairo Radio. If you missed our 9 o'clock hour, G shared some concerning personal news, and we need to bring in our favorite virologist, Dr. Angela Rasmussen, for some advice. Good morning, Dr. Rasmussen.
Good morning, Ursula.
You heard the news. I know that G contacted you. Yeah, so in case anyone didn't catch it, G caught COVID. And after two negative test results, his third one turned out positive. So we kind of pushed G to share the story because he was worried that he was going to scare people away from the vaccine. But I think this is exactly what we need to know, right, doctor?
That's right. So what people should know is that the vaccines are incredibly effective. I just got my vaccine yesterday. I got a single dose of Johnson & Johnson. And I have a lot of peace of mind knowing that I have excellent protection against getting sick from COVID-19, but I don't have complete 100% protection. There is no such thing as any vaccine that provides absolute protection against infection. And there will be a small number of people who get the vaccine who become infected, especially if they haven't gone 2 weeks after getting their second shot of the Pfizer vaccine that G got. So while it's super unfortunate, and I really feel for G being one of the unlucky few who has what's called a breakthrough infection, and that's an infection in a vaccinated person, it does happen, and people shouldn't be alarmed by that. That's completely normal. What people should keep in mind is that getting that vaccination actually will ensure that you are less likely to have severe illness. All of the vaccines are extremely protective against severe COVID-19, against hospitalization, and against death. And it sounds like G has actually had a pretty mild course of disease. That's probably because he was partially protected by that vaccine.
Yeah, considering he's doing the show from his bed, yeah, I would say.
I'm going to say this, and Ursula encouraged me, because some of this conversation I didn't want to talk about because I don't want to scare people. But at the same time, I want to tell the truth. And one of the things that you said to me last night on the phone, and I want to share this, Dr. Rasmussen, is that you shared that there is a good possibility that because I did have the first vaccine, the first dose, that it probably helped me from having a severe case.
That's right. I mean, we will never know for sure. And that's also what I told you last night. But, you know, the fact is you did have some mild symptoms. We already know from the clinical trials, as well as from some real world data that's coming in, that even one shot, 2 weeks after you get that shot, is very protective against symptomatic disease. So it's reasonable to think that if you had not had that one shot or that second shot, that you could have had a much worse case of COVID-19 if you weren't protected at all.
The other thing I want to ask you about now, we're getting all into personal business. I'm actually getting the second Moderna shot this week. And now we're hearing that women especially are so I've been warned by three different people, oh, the second shot is worse, especially for women. I'd heard already that the second shot you would feel, because the first one I felt nothing. So what is that about? What do we know about the second shot and women?
So with regard to there being sex differences, we do know that there are sex differences for actually getting COVID-19. We know that men are at a higher risk of getting severely ill and dying from COVID-19. So there are definitely sex biases that have been observed with this particular virus and the disease that it causes. It's a little bit less clear if that applies also in terms of women being more susceptible to side effects from the vaccine. And I haven't seen any data that really conclusively shows that. But one thing to keep in mind, too, is that my parents both got the Moderna vaccine. And for their second shot, they really didn't have much in the way of side effects, either one of them. And obviously, my father is male and my mother is female. Now, that's just an anecdotal situation, but I've certainly heard as well from colleagues who've gotten the Moderna shot where men had a difficult time with side effects after the second shot, and where women did not. So I think that this is something that is really not well understood. Anybody could potentially have severe side effects after the second shot. But even in the cases where those are more severe, more uncomfortable, where you might need to maybe take some Tylenol and stay in bed and call in sick from work, I have to say definitively, it is still a lot better than getting COVID-19. So don't let those potential side effects deter you from getting your second shot of Moderna or Pfizer. I think that people should realize that it will potentially, for some, a minority of people, be very uncomfortable for a day or two, but it sure beats being in the ICU.
Dr. Rasmussen, we got this question. This is a very good question for one of our listeners. Our daughter received her first shot as Pfizer And yesterday there was a communication error with her group of five and they received the Moderna shot. This was 21 days after the Pfizer shot. Is there any concern getting the Pfizer shot first and then the Moderna shot second? This has caused anxiety with my daughter, and we want to calm her worries. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And this has happened a few times. This is bound to happen anytime people are, you know, engaged in a national vaccine effort that includes multiple types of vaccines. But I think, you know, it hasn't been studied what happens if you get what's called a heterologous dosing regime. That's if you get, you know, start off with Pfizer or Moderna and then get a different vaccine for your booster. But what your friend's daughter should know is that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are actually quite similar. All of the vaccines use the same antigen. That's the same target for your immune system to train your immune system to fight COVID. And that's the spike protein of SARS coronavirus 2. Both the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna encode essentially the same spike protein. There's some slight differences. The Moderna vaccine is what's called a prefusion stabilized form of spike. That just means that the spike protein can last for a little bit longer after the vaccine produces it. But they're essentially the same thing. They're teaching your body how to make the same protein, and it's making the same immune responses to that protein. So there's probably not much of a difference in terms of getting the Moderna shot after you've gotten the first dose of Pfizer. And again, we don't have any data to back this up, but just knowing how vaccines work, knowing how these vaccines work, the daughter probably can rest easy that she'll have the same protection from that heterologous dosing regime as she would have had if she'd gotten two shots of Pfizer.
Dr. Rasmussen, we thank you for your time and your expertise as always, and congratulations on getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Oh, thank you so much. And I have to apologize if you heard some squeaking in the background there. That was my dog who decided that this was a great time to start chewing on her squeaky toys.
It's all good. We appreciate you. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. And feel better, G.
Hey, thank you, buddy. Appreciate it. Hey, Ursula, we do scenarios coming up next. And, you know, there have been a lot of people texting in and asking questions about my situation. So, what better scenario than to discuss is what's going on with me? And if you do have some more questions about what happened to me, how I got COVID, did I get the vaccination, what I went through, I feel like, Ursula, we should pay off a little bit of that, and we'll do that next. It's G and Ursula. It is the G and Ursula Show. We will do agree to disagree coming up next. And right now, this, don't play the music, but this scenario is brought to you by Farrah.com. As many of you guys know, I did open up in the 9 o'clock hour, and I admit it and let everybody know that I do have COVID-19. I did contract that, even though I have already received the vaccine. So the point and the reason why we're telling you this is number one, I'm thankful that my symptoms aren't worse than they are. And why that is, it could be the vaccine or it could not be. Either way.
I'm going to say it's definitely the vaccine. And you have been so, like, almost deathly fearful of getting COVID. And the fact that you are not hospitalized, and it is, like, for the longest time, you thought it was just a cold.
Right.
I'm going to agree with Dr. Rasmussen. I think that it could have been that much worse. And you barely made 2 weeks before you were in contact with somebody.
No doubt.
With the first vaccine, not the second.
So, Ursula, here's an angle that I wanted to bring up, because so often when we talk about COVID, the first thing people say, well, the ICU beds, this is how they look. They're great. And the deaths are great. And nobody is going to the hospitals. I want to tell you and show you the other side of this. And I want to tell you from my view, from what I'm seeing right now personally, this COVID and what we're going through can impact in so many ways that don't show up in the stat sheets. Here's what I mean. Right now, there's nearly about 30 people that are impacted by someone's selfish decision in this COVID deal.
How many people showed up to the gathering? So you had the quote unquote right number of people. right? In the
right.
backyard.
That was outside. Mm-hmm. But the person that the person that I was around, the people that I was around, is someone they were infected by someone else.
Yeah.
Right.
So a guy who went there to your gathering had been exposed at work and knew it but didn't tell anybody.
They were exposed at work, and then they exposed the person that I saw at the gathering.
So this was
another layer.
Yes.
So, but the part that I want to really let people know, I'm fortunate, okay? I get to do my show from here. There are some people who, like, even if you're exposed, right? So even if you're exposed and you have a negative test, some people still can't go to work. And there's some employment to where they don't pay you. They'll pay you if you are COVID positive and you have proof of that, but they don't pay you if you're not. So it's almost a double whammy. So for telling the truth and being transparent, you can sometimes be punished for that. And so that's the hard part. And see, like, some kids miss out on Easter. Some kids don't get to go be with family. Some kids might miss out on a trip. Like, COVID can really impact in different ways other than being the symptoms and being sick.
Mm-hmm. Good point. So, how many people in your gathering have now tested positive?
Right now, three. And it could be more, right? And by the way, of the ones that tested positive, of the three, there was a total of six negative tests within those three.
Mm.
So that's another one too. Like, mm-hmm. That's how science is weird. Like, the incubation period, like the time of exposure, right? You might say, well, 3 to 5 days. If you don't have it after 5 days, you're fine. No, it can be up to 14 days. Right. So you might have exposure and then you think you might have it. And then you say, you know what? Let me wait a week and let me go test. So you go and test and you're like, oh, I got a negative test. Then come to find out 3 days later, you start to get symptoms. And then it's like, well, wait a minute. I just had negative tests.
It was only on your third test that it came out positive.
It was only on my third test. But I told you and Chef, I said to you guys, I'm like, hey, I know I got negative tests, but I know my body. Something's up. Yeah. And this is weird for me to have a congestion like this in March. Now, I'll get some congestion in October, November, maybe, but not March. Yeah. And I don't have allergies.
Gee, I wanted to bring up something that this brought to mind for me. So the person that this originally came from, yes, they knew that there was a case at their office, but they had also tested negative twice, right? They had
also received their first vaccine.
Or was this the person?
No.
You were in
contact
with?
The person who had it from their office did not say anything, did not even tell anyone. That's the bad part.
G's friend. Who
yes.
came to the gathering who had no clue.
Right.
And then they only found out afterward when they got sick.
Yes, Ursula. And that friend of mine also has the vaccine.
Okay. And again, your symptoms are relatively mild. And I think it's because you got the shot.
Sure. But I'm grateful to be doing the show. Coming up next, we do Agree to Disagree. It's Gene Ursula.